Good morning and welcome to Wanda Sticks, the Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. Today we're going to rebroadcast a couple of special shows we aired earlier this week. The first rebroadcast is an interview with Joanna Highgood, the co-founder of Zaco Dance Theater, located in San Francisco. And she's going to be talking about Sailing Away, which is a site-specific dance production that's going to be taking place on Market Street in San Francisco, beginning at Powell on September 13th, and it's going to have various performances, start times, beginning on September 13th through September 16th, which is Sunday. And on Thursday, tomorrow, opening afternoon performances, there's going to be a special talk at the California Historical Society, which is located on Mission at 3rd. And I believe that starts about 5:30, perhaps. She's going to tell us. So we're not going to be able to play the entire interview, but we'll play about half an hour of it. And that's going to be followed by a live interview with Jorge Argueta, who's going to be talking about a children's book festival that's having it's going to be a duo book festival. It's going to be happening here in San Francisco, and then it's also going to be happening in Guatemala. So that's going to be really cool. And the Children's Book Festival, which has two parts, the book festival, and then there's going to be a poetry reading in the evening, and both of these events take place at Brava Theater. That's going to be on the 15th of this month, which is Saturday. The Children's Festival starts, I think, I don't want to give you the wrong time. So anyway, we just have to tune in. You tune in at 6:30 for that. And then we're going to play another pre-recorded interview, and that's going to be with two directors, Catherine Murphy, whose film Maestra had a screening at La Peña Cultural Center, and I believe that was last year, and it's just making the festival circuits, notwithstanding the fourth annual San Francisco Latino Film Festival. And we're going to speak to the director, Lucho Ramirez, along with Catherine Murphy, and then we're going to also speak to Kimberly Bautista, whose film, oh my goodness, her film is called Justice for My Sister, and it looks at the killing of a woman in Guatemala by her abusive partner. And and this film looks at femicide in Latin America and the successful pursuit of justice by this woman, a young woman who was killed. Her sister picks up the staff and pursues justice, and it's quite a remarkable story, and it's quite inspiring as well. So that's today, and so we're going to start off, as I mentioned, with Joanna Haygood and play most of the interview with her that was aired first on Monday this week, if you want to catch it all. All righty.
Yeah,
I'm so happy that you are bringing Sailing Away back to San Francisco because I missed it.
Oh, I'm really happy that you're going to see it because, you know, I really value your input, your feedback, your eye.
Hmm.
So I'm really excited that you're going to be able to experience it this time.
Oh, well, thank you so much. So tell my audience about the story of, you know, these, you know, prominent, you know, African-American citizens who decide to leave San Francisco.
Well, the story takes place in the mid-19th century, in the 1950s, when San Francisco was really just developing. It was just birthing. It was, you know, the gold rush had just started, and people were arriving, you know, by the thousands. To the city, and you know there was an enormous growth in population over just a few years. I mean, it went from like 500 to 35,000 in a few years. So because of that, you know, there was lots of chaos and you know, a lot of unruly and unlawful behavior, and you know, the Barbary Coast story is, I think, well known by many people, but it was, you know, the Wild West. And among all of these people who were coming, there were, you know, large, you know, by the standard of the day, numbers of African Americans considering moving to the West, you know, with the promise of a better life. And California has an interesting history in that it was brought into the Union as part of the Compromise of 1850, which was basically a compromise around the Fugitive Slave Act. So, in as a kind of an exchange between the kind of abolitionist states and the activists and the slaveholding states and the slaveholders, you know, in government, they traded this union for the passing of this law. And so there's this kind of tricky paradox about, you know, what later happened. You know, so California is admitted, and people are feeling like it had been a big prize for the abolitionists. But as African Americans started migrating, there was a fear among those here in California that there would be competition for, you know, for the riches that were going to be gained through this gold rush. So there was, you know, a Fugitive Slave Act that was passed here in California in 1852, and there were different laws that started popping up. You know, the governor tried to pass an exclusion law that would ban African Americans from migrating to California. And even though that didn't pass, there were a lot of laws that then started to spring up that would basically kind of squash any type of civil rights that African Americans would then have here. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of this interesting paradox between, right, we're going to, you know, create this free state, and yet, and people arrived here, you know, thinking that this would be true, and yet it ended up being, you know, similar to, you know, what people had left, or it was definitely far from the promise that they had actually expected. So this group, in this first wave, there were people who arrived, you know, people who had worked in the abolition movement, people who were scholars, who were free, some who were slaves that had bought their freedom. They were very educated people, mm-hmm. Incredible leaders and spokesmen and women, entrepreneurs, and they, you know, arrived trying to make their way, you know, through this, you know, the new land and the legislature that had been developed during that time. And I guess at some point, you know, we all give in. We all buckle to the pressures of and the stresses of this, you know, level of discrimination. And and I think the tipping point was when the legislature had passed the testimony, the right of testimony, which basically banned African Americans from testifying in court.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was an onslaught of varying crimes, you know, anywhere from robbery to, you know, beatings to murder, where African Americans wouldn't have any recourse for justice. So at that point, there had been a number of meetings. There had been conventions that had been held in Sacramento and also in San Francisco, where African Americans came together and discussed the, you know, all the various implications of the numerous laws at that point that had been passed and that were being introduced. And at some point, a group decided that they were going to start looking for a new place. Now, simultaneously, there was also a new gold rush that was happening up in Victoria along the Fraser River, and that seemed to, offer an opportunity to try something different, that there's going to be, another wave of immigrants moving. There'd be need for services and so on, and the possibility of working and basically settling in a new community where there would be less stress around, the issues that I mentioned.
Hmm.
And so they had gotten an invitation from the governor, who was actually mixed race, and he was very excited about the idea. And so over the course of the year, I'm now into 1858, hundreds of African Americans sailed up to Victoria and settled there.
Hmm.
And, that is right now, there's still an African American community there that can be traced back to this migration. Some of the characters in this particular piece, returned back to the United States after the Civil War, but many people remained there. So this piece is really about bringing this history to life, primarily because it's an extraordinary story,
mm-hmm.
but also because many of these people have, and their histories have disappeared from our memories here in this area. And, sometimes people will ask me about the piece and I will mention a few names, Mifflin Gibbs being one of them, or even Mary Ellen Pleasant, who I think enjoys, some notoriety, and some notice with local people. But many people don't know who she is and, they won't recognize any of the names of these characters.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, that their story is very, very important. And they also... they also speak to what's happening now in California and in San Francisco specifically around out-migration of African Americans. And I thought, that I had read an article, I guess when I first started working on this piece a couple of years ago, or when we first presented it, I had read an article about the number of African Americans who were leaving San Francisco, and I discovered this history kind of simultaneously, and I thought, how interesting, what an interesting parallel in that people are leaving for somewhat similar reasons, the lack of education, kind of the lack of, the lack of opportunity, all the consequences of all the discriminatory kind of social practices that have gone on for many, many years. I don't know if I should say education, but,
mm-hmm.
housing, crime, violence. And so I just thought that was really interesting, and that those two conversations, I think, are really important to have, and I think that this particular history is a great place to start, and all of the things that also it implies, just in terms of being African American in this country. We're always struggling for a place.
Mm-hmm.
We're like constantly on the move. We've migrated from the South up to the North, and then North up to the West, and there's this lack of kind of groundedness that I feel that we have, that we're constantly being uprooted, in search of this place that's going to be better for
mm-hmm.
us. And so anyway, so that's kind of in the long-winded response. kind of moving around in circles here, but that's kind of what the piece is about. And I'm,
mm-hmm.
I'm really happy this time that I have an opportunity to engage some scholars in this
mm-hmm.
area, people, historians who have really really, really researched this history in a much deeper way than I have. We've spent, you know, many years with a primary focus of kind of unearthing some of this history, as well as some people who have been working on these studies about the out-migration of African Americans over the last 20 and 30 years here in San Francisco. So they're going to be part of a panel that will be hosted by MOAD, the Museum of the African Diaspora, and the California Historical Society on our first day. So I'm really excited about that, and I'm very excited about learning more myself, because I don't feel like, you know, I have completely captured everything. I mean, it's, what's interesting about doing a piece like this is, and doing any kind of historical piece, is that every year there's new information.
Certainly.
There's new things that get discovered, and new information that actually, you know, discredits the information that you've just spent your, you know, last 3 years studying, and you know, it's all very, very interesting. So, but go ahead, you can ask a question, because I know.
Well, I just wanted to you know, let our audience know that Sailing Away is three continuous cycles, performances given in three continuous cycles, began on September 13th, 14th, 15th, and 16th, 12 noon, 1:30 p.m., and 3 p.m. daily, starting at Market and Powell. That's, you know, right where the cable car is.
Yeah.
Yeah, and all the stores.
Easy place to spot.
Right, definitely. And you know, people can just follow the dancers down Market as they sail away, and the discussion that's going to be hosted by MOAD, it's really exciting. The panel discussion is taking place at the California Historical Society, and that's 678 Mission Street at 3rd, and Thursday, September 13th at 5, and then there's going to be a reception after that. And I'm wondering, with regards to the performance from Dr. Shushil Bibbs, portraying the 19th century civil rights activist Mary Ellen Pleasant, is that for the school assembly, or is that for a part of the panel discussion, too?
It's for the school assembly.
Yeah, that's going to really be great, because you all are located in Bayview Hunters Point.
Yeah. And I'm very excited, and some of the children who will be at the assembly are kids that that we work with during the year.
Nice.
And I am hoping that this subject and this piece will be the focus of this year's work with the young people. But it is actually open. We've invited.
Oh, super.
We've invited people from the community to join us, and that's going to be on.
Yeah.
Tuesday.
So tomorrow, September 11th.
Yeah. Tomorrow.
Yeah. 10:30 in the morning.
10:30 in the morning.
Yeah. 4705 Third Street. That's the famous historic landmark on the Bayview Opera House. And so that's a school assembly with the performance, and then back to the panel discussion. Let's see, who are you going to have there? You're going to have yourself.
Sharon Hewitt from Clare, and
okay.
She sat on the Mayor's Commission for Out-Migration in 2009.
Okay.
She's going to bring a really interesting perspective. Jan Baptiste Atkins, who's just written and published a book called African Americans in San Francisco, and Dr. Shushil Bibbs, as you mentioned, she's going to be, she has spent a number of years researching and interpreting Mary Ellen Pleasant, and our moderator is going to be Gregory Hodge, who is a youth activist in our community.
Oh, that's great. So bridging the generations, too.
Yeah.
That's awesome. That's really excellent.
Yeah,
that's excellent.
Very excited about it.
Yeah. So you yourself, you know, migrated, over 30 years ago from the East Coast to the West Coast. And your dance company, which you co-founded, Zaco Dance Theater, you do performance work that investigates dance as it relates to place. And so all of your work has, you know, a sort of specificity of the ground and the area that it occupies. I mean, that's just as much a part of the piece as the dancers and the story. My favorite by far, it still is, even though I love everything, is when we were at the airport. And people were migrating, like coming in, you know, it's like, oh, how did we get here as African people? Yeah, that was so, so beautiful. People in the air, because you also have people flying in your pieces. Yeah. Although they're not going to be flying down Market,
no, they're
going to be walking.
Gonna be flying down Market. Yeah. That was a little bit out of our budget.
Yeah, so I was wondering if you could talk a bit about, you know, how you translated these stories of these people of African descent. I believe there are like 800 of them. And I remember going to this really wonderful sort of symposium at the African American Art and Culture Complex. And I think Reverend Amos Brown was there. Mm-hmm. And it was the 200th anniversary of this migration. And they had a big special thing that the Parks and the National Park Service was facilitating, and there was the Commodore, the steamer, the Commodore, was there. People could actually go to the pier and sort of reenact and re-experience. Yeah, it was the 150th anniversary, right? Commemoration. Yeah, and then here comes, you know, Joanna, like right on time. Like,
and I was really sorry that I missed that event. And you know, when I was speaking earlier about, you know, reading this article about the out-migration, and then I bumped into this other, you know, the articles about that particular event, and that's how that history started to make, you know, come to life for me. And so I was really sorry. I think it was just like, you know, I don't know, it was a matter of moments after it had happened. I was like, oh my God,
wow.
I can't believe that I missed that. It's really extraordinary. But I did have an opportunity to, you know, to speak with Guy Washington from the Park Service, and he shared all of his research with me. And
nice.
So I did have, you know, connection with, you know, that event in that way in terms mm-hmm. of the research. But I was sorry that I couldn't participate, you know, during that time. But I'll say that the piece itself is, there are the characters move down Market Street, and they have a series of solos that each of them do. They come together in different parts, and they create a number of tableaus along the way as well. And basically, you know, they're in period dress, and they are carrying different parts of the ship. You know, they have this big anchor, and there's a big ship's wheel. There's a bell, and you know, there are various other props that, you know, kind of work as different metaphors for their trip. And then there's a newsy character who hands out this newspaper along the way. She kind of accompanies the group and, you know, acts as a, you know, basically a newsie. And so there's a program that is in the form of a newspaper, obviously.
Mm.
And inside of the newspaper is a profile of each of the characters and some history behind the piece with historic photographs. And so people can kind of engage in the piece in a couple of ways. They can watch the characters, and of course all the performers are extraordinary. They're very, very strong.
Mm-hmm.
And especially within the context of this kind of like the, what I call the field of noise, you know, on Market Street. But having them kind of juxtaposed to the goings on of present day is very striking. And to think that these people, these specific people, were actually engaging in business and engaging with each other on this street, you know, in this area, you know, 150 some odd years ago, is also very striking. It's almost like, you know, their ghosts have come back, and yet they're kind of stronger than kind of, they don't feel ghostly, they feel real.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, you know, I wanted to make an installation piece, and I wanted it to be embedded in on the street, so it wasn't, it didn't have kind of a beginning. I mean, it does have a beginning and an end,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't exactly feel like that. It feels like it's ongoing, and I've often been interested in kind of this, you know, this notion of time and how we describe it and how we experience it, and you know, trying to see the two, you know, understanding that, you know, what our experiences are now are completely tied to what was then. So in fact, we're still, part of us is still living in the 19th century. You know, part of our ideas and, you know, our progress is based on what's happened. And so I think kind of seeing these two time frames kind of pushing against each other, you know, in this kind of parallel universe here, this parallel reality, is really interesting. And, you know, the characters don't exactly, they don't overtly interact with people on the street.
Mm-hmm.
They interact with each other, but they're very, but and at the same time, they feel very connected. You don't feel like you can't walk up to them and look at them and be close to them. But, you know, they're not going to talk. They don't speak during this show. So there's a really interesting relationship between the audience and the performers. And, of course, they're stunning in terms of the way that they look. I mean,
mm-hmm.
they're all very handsome people. And I tried to cast the show so the characters looked, there's something similar in the way that they look or feel to the characters that they're portraying.
Oh.
And they're dressed in really beautiful, you know, 19th century clothing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I wanted to say that, you know, not every African-American that migrated to San Francisco ended up, you know, or was, a well-off person. I mean, I think that there's, you know, range in class and opportunities even back then, and probably most were still very poor. But this particular group, these were very accomplished people,
mm-hmm.
And very highly successful in terms of their businesses. So I thought that was interesting. And actually, Sushil Bids is working on a piece about the Higher Sisters, the opera singers. Do you know them? They were born in the 50s. And I forget exactly. They were born somewhere here in California. I think they'd had some relationship to San Francisco, but were international opera stars.
Hmm.
And, you know, for this assembly, you know, I'd been thinking about it and doing some researching, and you know, I had never heard of them
mm-hmm.
either. And their history is really quite extraordinary. And as was their talent. And so while I was thinking about this assembly and adding music, you know, which there isn't any in the show, it's just the sound of the street, I started discovering all these really amazing African-American composers of the time, you know, and people, it's just people who are writing really sophisticated music, really, really profoundly beautiful music, and classical music, and you know, people who I've never heard of, who are just lost, you know,
because mm-hmm.
we're not hearing them on the radio, on the classical
stage.
You know, so anyway, so it's just like another thing. It's like, well, you know, there's so much dimension, you know, to our history, and somehow so much of it is lost. You know, now, you know, people have been finally talking about slavery, you know, but basically our history is being kind of defined completely through that lens, you know, and it's much bigger than that. I mean, not to say that that's, you know, that's not an important part or whatever, and they're gigantic, and, you know, I've done plenty of pieces around that history, and I think that we're still in recovery from that because it was so powerful. But you know, there's so much more. You know, it's the same thing as like, you know, all Africans, you know, were, you know, wild savages, you know, like this, like with this strange, you know, this strange picture that people have created. When it's like, but what about the mathematicians and the princes and the, you know, and the agriculturalists and the, you know, so it's just kind of the same thing in this country, too. You know, we're missing a lot, and a lot is getting lost. So I'm excited about kind of this new level for myself, in any case, and I want to be a part of, or you know, be able to contribute whatever I can in helping keep these histories alive.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, your work is always, you know, it's always so timely. I mean, it's entertaining, but it's also thought provoking. One can't ignore the lesson. And I was just thinking when I was looking at your website, Zacho.org, Z-A-C-C-H-O.org, and looking at some of the past works, and you don't have them all there, but you have the more recent ones. When you did The Monkey and the Devil, and we had a great conversation around that, you and I and the installation artist. Could you call his name for me? Because I don't.
Charles Chaplin.
Yeah, Charles Chaplin. And that was just so interesting when you all were talking about sort of you know, sort of the conversation that you had about race and how your lives sort of intertwined. And that was really interesting. But that was in 2008, and that was the same year, you know, 150th anniversary of this migration. And I think it's just really wonderful that these 800 black folks were doing well.
Yeah.
You know, and they had the choice. Like, we can charter, you know, a steam liner. And go leave here. I mean, you know, if it's not going to be pleasant for us, we don't have to just stay and take it. Yeah. So a lot of times people want to leave, but they don't have the resource. And these folks, they just, well, you know, And they were like, you know, sort of, they were anchors in the community. So when they left, their absence was felt.
Yeah.
And when they arrived in Victoria, their presence, you know, was, you know, sort of cultivated and made that place a lot richer.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so that's the, you know, we don't hear stories like that often. Like, you know, we're always like, oh, down and out and poor.
It's true. That's what I'm saying. It's like, you know, there's so much dimension, you know. We have we've been forced to create this very flat picture, you know. And so let's change that.
Yeah, certainly, certainly. So why this week? You know, this like 9/11, like, oh, okay, that's
well, you know,
and then you know, presidential conventions just ended, right? Mm-hmm. And this is an election year, and black folks, they're not sailing away because they want to sail away in San Francisco or other places to these hinterlands like Antioch and Bay Point and other states even sometimes.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if there was, I mean, I'm not sure that there was a significance of the time, the week, in that it just seemed to be like, let's do it. It's September. We're here.
Okay.
And at the same time, you know, I think that it, you know, how things do coincides with a lot of really important conversations that are happening, you know, around the election and around the who has and who hasn't. And I think this issue of out-migration here in San Francisco is an ongoing conversation, and that it's, you know, people have been, you know, trying to figure out how to stop it, you know, for a number of years. And that was kind of the point of Gavin Newsom's commission, you know, to figure out how do we keep African Americans in San Francisco. You know, I mean, I don't think that there's been any real headway or success at this point. I mean, but I think that this is something that people are actively trying to figure out, like, you know, what are we doing? What are we doing wrong? Well, of course, you know, we could name, you and I could probably name 100 things right now. But, you know, how to solve this dilemma, I think it's going to take a lot of aggressive work and in a lot of different areas. So I think what tends to happen is that, you know, commissions get created and people come up with recommendations, and then, you know, new mayor comes in or whatever happens, they just get tabled.
Mm-hmm.
And people change their mind about where they need to put priorities, and, you know, we don't really change. So, but I'm hoping, you know, I mean, I'm hoping that this conversation that happens at the Historical Society can inspire others to have more conversations, and that some actions can actually be born out of them. So, mm-hmm. And you know, one thing leads to the next. I mean, first you got to bring it up,
right?
And you have to get people in the room to talk
mm-hmm.
about it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, because one thinks when you know we contemplate, you know, the migration of 1858 to Victoria, and you know, your piece Selling Away, based on that, those stories, the end of enslavement, and you know, the white folks saying, okay, what do we do with these black people? Let's
mm-hmm.
send them back to Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was, yeah, and then there was this, you know, this out migration to Liberia,
mm-hmm.
and what the baggage that African Americans took with them to Africa, and all the trouble that caused, you know, all the turmoil and unsettling kind of relationships that developed between those that were born in America and went mm-hmm. to Africa, and those that were indigenous African, you know, 150 years later,
mm-hmm.
You know, and all the war and
yeah.
And how, you know, it, I mean, it's really wonderful, you know, that Lema Bowie and the women that prayed peace into their country, and, you know, the president, Shirleaf, you know, is there as the first woman president on the continent of Africa, and there are not that many women presidents in the world, so, yeah.
For that matter.
Exactly. So it's like, whoa, man, it's like in the connections there. So, so when I think about the shrinking populations of black people in these urban centers, one wonders, if we leave, will you miss us?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and do you value our presence, those that are, few of us that are left, or would you just like us to just disappear or just vanish?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, I think that we will be missed. I mean, you know, we bring, you know, a richness in culture. I mean, I think in any community, a very unique and important perspective of what this country actually is. I think, you know, I think it would be impossible not to be missed. I mean, it's like, even though that may not be recognized at the onset. And I think that, you know, a lot of people in San Francisco don't see how segregated the city is. You know, people who live in, you know, Nob Hill, or, you know, wherever they live on the, you know, downtown, or, I mean, you know, they don't get a sense, or they don't recognize, they don't see, they're somehow blinded to the fact
mm-hmm.
that San Francisco is very segregated, and people don't know that there's actually an out migration going on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're very, very removed. I mean, I think San Franciscans like to think they live in an equitable, highly diverse community, or, you know, city.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you know, it's basically being taken over by the upper middle to upper classes, and it is, you know, moving the poor, you know, poor, and particularly the African Americans out of the city. I mean, we're basically, I mean, if you were to go down to to Bayview, you can start to see the shift. Now, there's other places. I mean, I think the Asian American.
Ah, well, that was Joanna Haygood, co-founder of Zaco Dance Theater, speaking about Sailing Away, which, again, starts on Thursday, September 13th, at the Powell Street and Market at, I believe it's 12 o'clock, and you can watch the dancers sail away down Market Street. And these performances are going to be happening. I think they're like three or so each day, and it's free, and it goes through Sunday. We are joined in the studio, I'm so happy, by Jorge Agueta. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm glad you called in. Perfect timing.
Thank you.
Yeah, to tell us about this wonderful, the first annual Flor y Canto para Nuestros Niños y Niñas with children's poetry workshops from 9 to 12 noon at Brava. And then there's going to be this great poetry reading in the evening, and it's all the fundraiser for the festival that you started 3 years ago, I believe, this year?
3 years ago, yeah, we started in El Salvador.
Right, yeah. And you are a celebrated Salvadorian poet and writer whose bilingual children's books have received numerous awards, and your poetry has appeared in anthologies and textbooks. You won the American Book Award, among other awards, for your first collection of poems for children, A Movie in My Pillow. You were the Gold Medal Award winner in the 2005 National Parenting Publications Awards. It's nice for Mooney Luna, Lunita Lunero. And your other books for children include, how do you pronounce it, Xochitl?
Xochitl.
Uh-huh. And The Flowers, 2003 America's Award commended title. And the trees are hanging from the sky, Zapitio, talking with Mother Earth. Did I mispronounce that?
No.
Oh, okay.
Fine. Thank you.
The Little Hand in the City and the Fiesta of Tortillas. And your workshops have been hosted in such diverse venues as schools, libraries, museums, juvenile halls, universities, colleges, shelters, television, radio, hospitals, art programs, and child care providers conferences. So tell us about this organization that you started. I don't even want to kill it. So tell me how to say it. Taleras de Poesía?
Talleres de Poesía.
Ah, okay. Not too bad.
No, at all.
Yeah, and this festival that you host in El Salvador is in November, and there's one coming up this November, and so this festival for children here in San Francisco in the Bay Area, which is great, sort of parallels your festival, only the one in El Salvador is over 3 days, right?
Yes, exactly.
Thank you for reminding me.
Oh, my God. It's a empty, you know, for the last 4 months of my life I dedicated to that, you know. And I bring people along with me, you know.
Yeah, you take some. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell us about, you know, sort of the festival in El Salvador and about the festival this weekend on Saturday at Brava.
Sure. In El Salvador, you know, I hook up with poets, musicians, writers, and cultural workers, you know. And I decided to bring a poetry festival from San Francisco. And I have a group of talented people that work along with me, you know, Holly Ayala, Rafael Duon, Mario Lopez. Magda, there's many people who work along really tirelessly with this to do fundraising for this for both events, you know. And in El Salvador, 3 years ago, you know, we started to bring this poetry festival there's a big need for literary events in our country.
Mm-hmm.
And we work with children in different sectors of the society. You know, some of them really poor children who probably would love to read, but there's no books. You know,
mm-hmm.
and so there's a lot of violence in this. These societies, you know. So through poetry, we bring them a different perspective of life, you know, and another way of seeing the world. And poetry brings them hope, you know. Reading, the art of reading, writing, is something that really touches them in a wonderful way and opens doors for these children, you know. So now this Floricanto that is happening this September 15th here,
mm-hmm.
is like a brother sister to this other festival in El Salvador. You know, but we also wanted to give up to this community here in San Francisco that has been helping us in different ways by providing us sometimes the monetary help that we need. You know, people donate $5 here, $2 there, $10. Or they come to different readings that we host to raise funds, you know. So we decided to have a Floricanto. Floricanto is a festival that is gonna start on the morning of September 15th,
mm-hmm.
in Brava Theater, 2781 24th Street. The morning part of this Floricanto is, Floricanto means flower and song for our children. That's basically what it means.
Okay.
And poets such as Francisco Alarcón, Francisco Herrera, Herbert Romer, Lucha Corpi, Maya Cristina González, René Colato, and myself, we are gonna be doing a poetry reading and presenting our books, you know. Mm-hmm. But we're also it's gonna be fun. You know, we also have the bookmobile coming. We have some little chickens that are gonna be there too, you know, and we have face paintings, we have arts and crafts, so it will be a wonderful morning, and that's completely free,
mm-hmm.
for our community. For anybody who wants to come in on this Friday, it's gonna be a wonderful opportunity to have. We're also gonna be selling books, very cheap books, $1.
$1,
you know?
Wow, nice.
$1. We wanna give and receive. That's what we like, you know. That's what we like to do to our children here too. You know, want them to feel appreciated, and we want our community to feel appreciated, and we want them to know that we appreciate their help too.
Mm-hmm.
So in the afternoon, we're gonna have from 5 to 7. We're gonna have a big reception with lowriders. Park on the street, and poets are going to take rides, and there's lowriders. We're going to have active sensors. Yeah, it's going to be beautiful, you know.
Mm.
And we're going to have food, pupusas. We're going to have, again, the sale of books by some of the poets, you know. And at 7, we're going to start with this with the reading. And we're going to honor Juan Felipe Herrera, the poet laureate of California,
mm-hmm.
Alejandro Murguía, the recently crowned poet of San Francisco, Francisco Alarcón, Lucha Corpi, Mama Coat, many, many wonderful poets and writers from San Francisco and from other cities, you know. So it's going to be a great event. And this one, we are charging $15 and $20. But no one is torn away for lack of funds, you know. So
right.
Whoever is listening out there, you know, and wants mm-hmm. to come and think, oh, that's too much money, you know. No, we don't. You know, we're not going to say no to anybody. That's just, it's a donation, you know. Whoever
right.
wants to come.
Yeah. And people can get more money too, right?
But of course, yeah. It's exactly it.
Yeah, you're not going to turn away any donations because all of this is going to the to the program that you're going to be hosting in November, your third annual. I was noticing that Avacha is also participating, and Jenny
Lim. Oh, yes.
I think you mentioned Dr. Loco, Nina Serrano, you know, wonderful storyteller and KPFA host. I think you were on her show. Some really, really fine, fine poets and writers. And I was reading this really great story about one of your recruits who is a Salvadorian native, but she hadn't been home since she came here. I think it was like 25 years before, you know, when she was brought here as a child. Let's see, her name is Renee Colato. How do you pronounce her last name?
Laines.
Laines, yeah. And it just sounds like she just had a great time and has been going ever since, you know, to support the wonderful festival of books and writing in El Salvador.
It's such a wonderful festival, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you the story that you mentioned about Renee. Such a wonderful story. I met Renee many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was very young, he was around going to poetry festivals, meeting poets, writers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he always talked about going back to El Salvador and why he came over, you know. And now as an author, you know, he went with us, and I remember taking him back to the airport. So we just took him by spin to the ocean, you know.
Mm.
And he wanted to touch the water, you know, nice and warm water, you know. First thing, he got all wet. The waves came in, you know. He thought it was safe, but the water got kind of rowdy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he got all wet, but he didn't mind that. He says, you know, because he felt that warm again, that really beautiful touch of that warm water all over his body, his face, his, you know, and he was really happy to feel that, you know. And he said, well, you know, that's why I came to touch the water after 25 years. He said, you know, 80 years, and now he's giving back to the children. Now he's giving back to his country, you know. He can't hardly wait to go back. He's hosting events in Los Angeles, where he lives in LA.
Okay.
He's doing one or two events for these readings.
Nice. Yeah. He talks about you know, his book, The Tooth Fairy Meets El
El Raton.
Yeah. Paris, and how the children didn't know, like, tooth fairies. What is a tooth fairy? And that sounded really fun. And he has a lot of other children's books. I was wondering, this particular festival for this year is November 14th through 16th, and of the poets that are going to be reading on Saturday, either in both programs or just participating in the first part, how many poets from here are going?
Francisco Alarcón, René Colato, and hopefully we're going to be taking Margarita Robleda, who's from Mexico, and myself, you know.
Okay.
And then we have the people who coordinate the event who work already there and who are coming from here too. You know?
Right.
So it's a big event. It's a wonderful chance for these children to read, to write. When we get there, you know, the children take buses from their communities outside of San Salvador.
Mm-hmm.
3-4 hours away from the capital, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then they jump into these buses, they come into this bus and into the city. They get there like around 8:30, 9. We're already waiting for them. We have big banners that says, welcome to the third Children's Poetry Festival, long live reading, or viva la lectura, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there's clowns that recite poetry to them when they come in, you know. And it's very beautiful. So these children, their faces light up, and they say, wow, this is all for you, you know. We were told that you are some amazing kids, and we come in here to read with you and to tell you stories and to hear your poetry, and children really love that, you know. And I know that they are taught in a beautiful way, you know, and I know that maybe one, two, four of them will never forget that experience, you know. And that's what the importance of this festival is, you know, that you really get to the heart of the children, you know, that really need to hear the voice of poetry, the voice of hope that lives in the heart of poetry, on the heart of reading, writing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how reading and writing opens so many different wonderful roads of opportunities for our children. You know, a child who reads is a child who will open doors. A child who writes is a child who will open many ways for him or herself, and for others too. You know, things they think, they act, they move around in a very delicious way, and they want the same for their communities. You know, create leaders, good leaders. That's what we want. You know, children with opportunities of peace and hope for them. You know, here and in anywhere in the world. You know, in El Salvador, it might be anywhere. You know, that's the wonderful thing about poetry. You know, the heart that rises and of hope and for children. That's what poetry does, and that's what we like for our children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was noticing that the event in El Salvador is it's also, you collaborate with organizations there and the National Library, Francisco Gavidia, hosts the festival, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I was wondering, do you have any youth? This is your third event, so you probably have children that have been coming, you know, like this is, like last year you might have had children that were there the first year. This year you might have children that have been to both festivals. And do you involve any youth in the poetry performances and reading and sharing?
Yeah. Oh, yes, indeed. This is a pretty intense 3-day festival, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The morning is dedicated to children, and then in the afternoon we have young people come in, you know.
Okay.
And then sometimes in the evening we host the reading, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, and one of the days is dedicated to teachers too, you know. So,
oh.
In other words, mm-hmm. we want to create a culture of readers, you know,
mm-hmm.
writers, reading, thinking people, you know. I mean, they already exist, you know.
Right.
It's not like we teaching El Salvador how to be a writer. No, it's not like that, you know. It's just that we see a need and we try to provide what we can, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I was wondering for our audience if you could maybe tell us your story. You know, how you came to be such a renowned writer and you know, and some of the writers that inspired you, you know, Salvadorian writers and other writers that inspired you to find your voice through literature.
Well, you know, I grew up in a small town in El Salvador, you know, and, listening to stories, my grandmama, you know, always was telling stories. Then my family owned a small restaurant in El Salvador, you know, and many people came in telling stories. So I grew up between storytellers, and my father was somebody who loved to read. You know, I from a very young age, I was reading local poets in El Salvador. And then, you know, start reading internationally known writers, Walt Whitman, Pablo Neruda,
mm-hmm.
many writers, many poets that had influenced me through the years. You know, Italian poets, Cabafi. You know, I had put my hands in every aspect of of literature, whether it's poetry or prose or any other novels. You know, I love to read García Márquez. You know, there's been a wonderful Emily Dickinson. You know, all these wonderful writers. I think that literature, you know, it's something that I have seen work on myself in a beautiful way, and I'm a witness, you know. I have been in trouble in my life too, and by reading, by writing, by doing poetry, you know, and bringing poetry to children, I have found many ways to heal my heart, my soul, my spirit, you know, and I believe in that. I believe that poetry has that wonderful spirit, you know, and I see that. I can feel that, you know. So yes, I like the poet Jack Hirschman, a local poet here in San Francisco. I like his energy, you know. He's a contemporary poet, but I also like some of the beatnik poets, Ginsberg as well. You know, I also enjoy the poetry of Claudia Lars in El Salvador. You know, I also enjoy the novels by Carlos Fuentes. You know, and so on and so forth. You know, so many poets and writers. Men and women that have influenced us, you know, and continue to, you know. So it's a wonderful, wonderful world of literature out there.
So maybe you might like to share some of your work with us on the air this morning. Maybe you want to share a poem or a story or, you know, whatever you're feeling. And I was just looking up El Salvador and didn't realize that it meant Republic of the Savior. Is that the name the indigenous people named this country, or is this a name that was given to it by the colonizers?
I think that San Salvador was a name given by the Spaniards, you know. The real name is Cuscatlan, you know, which means land of the jewels, you know.
Oh, that's pretty. You know?
Yeah. See, much better, huh?
Yes. Yeah.
I love to share a poem with you and your audience, and I also want to remember them about this Saturday, September 15. You know, please bring your children. You know, and it's going to be a beautiful poetry event, workshops, fun activities. You know, and in the evening we have this crazy, wonderful reception. Food and arts and crafts, lowriders,
and Aztec dancers. That's going to be really fun. Yeah, and Bravo Theater Center, let me give people the address, is located at 2781 24th Street in San Francisco. And both events, the Children's Poetry Workshops from 9 a.m. to 12 noon, and the Flor y Canto Reception at 5. And the event at 7, all of that happens right there in front or inside of Bravo Theater Center. It's 24th at York, Y-O-R-K, that's the cross street. Sort of central and to, in would you call it, is that still the Mission where Bravo is or no?
Yeah. Yes,
it is Mission.
It is.
Okay.
It's right on York near Potrero. Potrero is the other street. It's between York and Potrero.
Right.
On 24th. You know,
right, and the phone number. Yeah, and the box office is brava.org, brava.org, or you can call 415-647-7657. 57 extension 1 for tickets.
Great.
Okay.
Yeah, that's and some other participants, Leticia Hernandez, Lorna Di Cervantes, Lucha Corti, Pablo Calderaro, Rosa Munda Yalas, Rene Colato, Paula Tejeda, some of them are local poets, musicians, and a really beautiful, beautiful people that accept to get together for this event, you know. So it's going to be a wonderful opportunity to hear all these poets, you know, and musicians as well. And here's my poem.
Okay.
Okay, it's called Flor y Canto para Nuestros Niños y Niñas. Flower and Song for our Children. Flower and Song for our Children. Song of Peace. Flower of Justice. Flower Song. Song, Flower of Hope. Song of Love. Flower and Song. Song and Flower every day and every night. Flower and Song. Song and Sun. Rising every morning as a wonderful song of life, of love, of justice, peace, and hope. Flower and song in the hearts of the children. Flower and song in the water and the four directions. Flower and song for everyone and the wind and the mountains and the spirit of our Mother Earth. Flower and song to live this sweet life. Xochitl, Huantacuiga, Xochitl, Huantacuiga. Flower and song to live this sweet life. Xochitl, Huantacuiga. Xochitl, Huantacuiga. Thank you.
Oh, wow. Thank you. Wow, that was really beautiful.
You know, my grandmother always says, you know, whistle like the birds.
Mm-hmm.
So that happiness, that beauty will nest in your heart, you know. So I have hope, you know, for this event. It's a lot of work, you know. It's a lot of work doing this festival, you know. But I have hope that somebody out there is listening, you know, and will come to this event and will help us out, you know. I just want to mention a few names, you know, like I said before, I mentioned some names, but I want to mention somebody who really works tirelessly in this. Her name is Holly Ayala, you know. She's the coordinator of these events. And sometimes these people always stay in the back, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But morning and afternoons and night, they're doing all this, you know. And I'm the one who make phone calls and, you know, and receive all this beautiful opportunities to talk like people like you, you know, talk about my work and talk about poetry. But there are other people who stay in the back, you know, and don't say a word.
Mm-hmm.
And they are the pillars of all this work, you know.
Right.
So I want to just say that, you know, that it's not just me. There's many other people who are doing this work together, you know. So thank you so much for the opportunity.
Oh, you're welcome, Jorge. Wanted to ask you if there is a website if people want to send you lots of money, you know, after the event, you know, before November and even while you're in El Salvador. Is there a place where people can go to find out more about, you know, the Flor y Canto para Nuestros Niños y Niñas, you know, here and also in El Salvador? Do you have a website something?
Yeah, we have a website. It's called Talleres de Poesía. It's one whole word. .wibli.com. We have online bank account.
Oh,
I don't know if it's actually a bank account, but it's like a online page where people can donate money if they please. It's called Acting Giving.
Oh, super.
So if anybody out there hears this, you know, there's actinggiving.com, and you can write the word Festival of Poetry in El Salvador, you know, mm-hmm. and you will see pictures of the children and pictures of poets doing their work, you know, and you can mm-hmm. see that the library, Francisco Gavidia, as you said it, and you can get more in details of what we're talking about here, you know.
Okay, super. How do you spell the website? Could you spell it out for us?
Yeah, PALLERESVEPOESIA .weebly.com. Talleres de Poesía .weebly.com.
So the Weebly is WEEBLY?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, cool, super. All right, excellent. Well, great. Well, I look forward to seeing you either at the children's. Maybe I can bring my granddaughter, interest her in coming out. She's 9. I'm sure she would love it. And
And then
I want to try to make myself fit into my schedule to come to the Great Poetry Reading, because you're gonna have like a lot of the superstars there. Yeah,
it's gonna be fun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Wow. Well, thank you so much for joining us to talk about, you know, this wonderful event, the first annual in San Francisco, and the fundraiser for the third annual event in El Salvador. I'm really happy to know about it. I mean, the first annual and the third annual, even though I didn't know about, you know, what's going on in El Salvador until this year. Now I know. maybe
you know,
one year I could come.
Poetry.
That would be fun.
Yeah. Well, we need poetry everywhere, all over, you know, bus stops and hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
No matter where, you know, poetry and art, that's what I mean, you know.
Yeah. Keeps us human. Yeah,
exactly.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, you take good care. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Oh, you're welcome. Peace and blessings.
Bye.
Bye-bye. I wanted to announce that today, September 12th, is the 14th, the anniversary of the 14th, the 14th anniversary of the arrest of the Cuban Five, and there are some national events happening. If you're in Washington, D.C., or New York City, or San Francisco, there are some organizing activities happening, and today, Wednesday, September 12th at 8 o'clock, there's going to be an event at the Venezuelan Embassy, Bolivian Hall, 2443 Massachusetts Avenue Northwest in Washington, D.C. And on Friday, September 14th at 7:30, there's going to be an evening of solidarity to commemorate the 14th anniversary of the arrest of the Cuban Five. And that is going to be at the Festival Center, 1640 Columbia Road Northwest in Washington, D.C. And that program is going to feature various speakers: Rafael Consal Miranda, Puerto Rican independence fighters sentenced in 1954 to 84 years in prison in the United States. And due to international pressure, then President Jimmy Carter granted him amnesty in 1979 after 25 years in prison. Consal Miranda is a poet and author of 7 books and remains active in the struggle for the Puerto Rican independence and freedom of Puerto Rican political prisoners. Tom Hayden is also going to be speaking, and he was a founding member of the Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, in 1961. In 1968, he played a leadership role in protests outside the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, where he was indicted along with folks like Black Panther founder Bobby Seale on federal charges of conspiracy as one of the Chicago Eight. And Hayden served in the California State Assembly from 1982 to 1992 and the State Senate from 1992 to 2000. and currently he is a writer and editor of The Nation and director of Peace and Justice Resource Center in Culver City, California. And Liz Diaris serves as the Training and Capacity Building Director of the Praxis Project, a movement-building intermediary organization in Washington, D.C., and she is the narrator on the documentary COINTELPRO 101, produced by Freedom Archives. Wonderful film. And our good friend, Makani Temba, she's also a member of the Praxis Project. I think she might actually be the founder. Michelle Tingling Clemens is a local, national, and international social and human rights activist and organizer in D.C., and she is a co-founder of the National Welfare Rights Union and the Metropolitan Washington Hiroshima Nagasaki Peace Committee. And Jose Pertiera is an immigration attorney. He represents the government of Venezuela in the extradition case involving Luis Posada Carriles. And there's going to be a special guest, Vicente Valio and Alejandro Valdez. So, what a mouthful. It's going to really be great. Great event. And for information, call 202-787-5229 or 510-219-0092. And in New York, there's going to be a concert with Vicente Falu and Alejandro Valdez, and that's going to be this Saturday, September 15th at 8 o'clock at the SEIU Healthcare Workers East, and that's at 1199 SEIU Healthcare Workers East, and that's going to be at 310 West 43rd Street in New York. And the endorsers are World Organization for Right of People to Healthcare Incorporated, IFCO, Pastors for Peace, Casa de las Americas, July 26th Coalition, and the National Network on Cuba. And again, for information, you can call 917-412-4451 or 510-219-0092. And in San Francisco, on Wednesday, September 19th at 7:30 at La Pena Cultural Center, 3105 Shattuck Avenue in Berkeley, there's going to be a concert with Vicente. They're making the rounds. Alejandro is going to be joining him. And Rafael Manriquez is going to be rounding out that ensemble. And then on Thursday, September 20th at 8 o'clock, there's going to be an event at Brava Theater, the same place where the first annual Florida Canto is happening this Saturday. This is next week, Thursday, September 20th at 8 o'clock. And Brava, again, is 2781 24th Street in San Francisco. And there are a whole lot of great endorsers, Brava Theater, Radio Bilingual, Radio KPFA, KPOO, which needs donations. Send some money to KPOO. They need money to keep operating. La Peña, No Right Turn, La Bohemia Productions, and the National Network on Cuba. And for information, call 510-219-0092. And I want to remind people that L.A. Rebellion is continuing at Pacific Film Archive. And this week, Thursday, September 13th, 7 o'clock, is going to be a screening of Bush Mama, Holly Jerima's 1995 classic in a new print, and Cornelius Moore, programmer for California Newsreel, is going to be introducing the film. And this Halle Jerima's first feature takes chances and projects an urgent sense of personal necessity, a raw, fragmented study of a Watts welfare mother's political awakening, and that's from The Village Voice. And it's preceded by Bernard Nicholas's Daydream Therapy, and the whole program is 105 minutes. And again, that's at Pacific Film Archive, which is located at UC Berkeley on Bancroft at Bowditch. And it's going to really be a great program. And then next week, Wednesday, September 19th, 7 o'clock, all these films, I think they're all filming, they're all screening at 7 o'clock. And these wonderful L.A. Rebellion, Creating a New Black Cinema screenings continue through October 30th. So they started on September 6th. It's almost like 2 months of wonderful screening of films that have not had a wide circulation. And it's really, really wonderful that this this series of films that were curated for LA Standard have, you know, made it on up to UCLA sister campus at UC Berkeley and Pacific Film Archive is such a wonderful venue for, you know, giving us a wide range of cinema experiences, and we're really happy that they do that kind of work. And so we had a wonderful interview with the curator, one of the curator of the team that put together this series of films, Jacqueline Stewart. We had a really wonderful interview with her, and I would like to play that interview. I really would like to play that interview. And I was supposed to play, I might play part of that interview and then shift over. I'm not sure how to do this. So I'm going to play a little bit of that interview, and then I'm going to shift over to the interview that I had with the programmer, Lucho Ramirez, and two directors about the San Francisco Latino Film Festival, which is having its fourth anniversary. And it also kicks off tomorrow, the 13th. There's just so much to do in the Bay Area. My goodness, you cannot go wrong. So, again, I'm going to play a little bit of that interview with Jacqueline, and then I'm going to shift to the interview with the other directors. Let's play just a smidget of that. Yeah, this wonderful series of films that you have curated is just phenomenal. L.A. Rebellion, Creating a New Black Cinema. It's really interesting how the whole idea of black cinema, you know, new and old, is always kind of, it's evergreen, you know, as a theme.
I think that's right. Yeah. I mean, I think that there's so much material that people haven't seen, or they think they know, and they don't really know, so that it always seems new, like you're saying. There's always something more to learn from it, I think.
Yeah, and then when you think about, you know, sort of imaging, you know, African, people of African descent, Pan-African people, and, you know, your directors are definitely represent a real range of viewpoints.
Yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the amazing things about this LA Rebellion group is that they really reflect a lot of different black experiences.
Mm-hmm.
So you have people who are coming from all parts of the United States, and then you have students who are at UCLA who came from other countries. So folks like Haile Garima, who is Ethiopian. There are a number of Nigerian filmmakers, a few filmmakers from the Caribbean, for example. Bernard Nicholas is from Haiti. And so what they brought together was a kind of Pan-Africanist view. They were also watching a lot of films that were coming out of Africa in the 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And so they became very interested to try to use film in a way that they saw their third world brothers and sisters using film, which was, for, you know, for the purposes of liberation.
Yeah. So why don't you talk a bit about how you pulled this wonderful series together, you know, which covers a couple of months.
Sure.
And I'm so happy that it's in Northern Cal, you know, that, you know, PFA
really
was, you know, able to collaborate with you all and get it up here. That's really awesome.
Yeah. And I should say that I'm part of a team of people who worked on this.
Okay.
This is a series, a project that grew out of the UCLA Film and Television Archive.
Right.
The project really began with a really huge initiative that was funded by the Getty Foundation. They did this really extraordinary series of activities that was called Pacific Standard Time.
Yeah, I caught some of that.
Yes. So this was an effort that they spearheaded to try to document post-war art in Southern California. And so just about every major cultural institution in Southern California had some kind of show, art shows, performances. UCLA Film and Television Archives did this project and this film series. as a way of trying to reconstruct the history of creativity and the creation of art, modern art.
Good afternoon and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. And today we are joined by the director of the San Francisco Cine Latino Film Festival, which is kicking off on September. Is that September 13th? Is that when it's kicking off?
That's right, Wanda. Thanks so much for having me on your program. The Cinema San Francisco Latino Film Festival kicks off this Thursday at the Blue Macaw with a special musical event, but then we carry on with films as of Friday.
Right, yeah. Yeah, we're joined in the studio by Lucio Ramirez, who is the, you know, the chief executive, you know, the person that's making all these things happen, and I'm so happy you could join us as you're, like, installing films and just testing the sound and...
That's exactly what I just came from.
Right. Yeah, you have a lot of films that you're going to be premiering, and this is your third season as director, right?
Right. This is our fourth season, and we have 42 films, including features and shorts from 13 countries. So
Wow. We're
very excited, and definitely a lot of premieres, West Coast, California, U.S. premieres. So it really is a diverse lineup that, you know, people should come out, considering a lot of these films are independent that you will probably not even see on Netflix.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And I noticed in your Cine Mas, I guess, viewer guide and schedule,
Yeah. You've
got the films by category, and you have... you know, films from Argentina and Brazil and Chile and Cuba and El Salvador and Guatemala and Mexico and Peru and Puerto Rico and Spain and good old USA that has everybody living here. And and you've got Uruguay and Venezuela. And then you divide them into categories. You've got art and culture and society and comedy and romance and drama and immigration and human rights and political and historical and lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender and thriller and action. So how long did it take for you all to pull together, you know, this great festival? And what year is this for the festival?
This is our fourth season, and it really is a long, long, long process that starts, for the most part, as soon as the season concludes.
Mm-hmm.
But we go really kind of full throttle from March of the year. We should be doing it since January, but let's just say around March is when we really kind of start getting all the films coming in, and by the summer we make decisions, and then it's a lot of back and forth and slotting and raising money and getting volunteers and that sort of thing.
Yeah. So opening night, what do you have in store for your audiences? And I know you have a variety of venues. I mean, you're not just in, you know, in theaters. You're also in community centers, and you're in multiple cities, and you have films for the family, you have films for youth, and like you mentioned, you know, you have a musical event. So talk about, you know, opening night and some of the highlights of this fourth season.
Right. One of the highlights, I would say, is definitely kicking off with a musical event. One of the things that I envisioned for our organization was to delve into cultural events that went beyond film, though film being the central part of what we do. So we have screenings throughout the year, but the festival itself represents the cornerstone of what our organization is, basically our signature event. But we'd always wanted to include other elements. So this year we decided to start with a musical event. And we'll have a Latin Grammy-nominated band headlining. It's called La Santa Cecilia. And they have kind of like an upbeat American take on Latin American music. And they're a band based out of Los Angeles that are here. And we'll have a couple of other musical acts performing. So that event's at the Bluma Caw in San Francisco, and it opens at 8 and goes till 2 in the morning. But basically, we'll be showing some clips. We'll be showing clips of films and other sort of surprises there, raffling things off and giving things away over the course of the evening. And then, of course, on Friday, we go ahead and start with films.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there's kind of a musical end to that. Our opening night film is Silly Brown, which is it's a film set in Los Angeles of a young, headstrong woman that is basically conflicted with choices she has to make between in her pursuit for a musical career and also family situation that's a little bit challenged.
Yeah, that's a Philly Brown. It's an excellent film. But before we talk about Philly Brown, which I actually was able to watch, I wanted to go back to the festival kickoff friend raiser, as you put it, which is really nice. The Candelaria band that's going to be performing as well. They sound really interesting, and they're over in the East Bay. They're in Oakland, and they're doing a type of music called cumbia.
Right.
Can you talk about a little bit about them?
Yeah, well, they were, since I'm working with another organization that's very familiar with how we work, and they're also an organization that works with a lot of different nonprofits as far as bringing musical acts to the city, for the most part, singer-songwriters. They were excited and they co-presented with us on a couple of occasions any sort of biopic or music-oriented films. And they're called La Bohemia. And we decided this year to work with them in putting together this show. And they were familiar with Candelaria and the musical format that they perform. And for both of us, our interest was really in having music that really makes you want to dance, music that makes you feel good. It's not the kind of music that you just stand and tap your finger or move your head back and forth. Things that really kind of get your body moving. And so we're excited. We're both excited to work with this group and have them come in from the East Bay and, you know, a little bit of back and forth between these different communities.
Yeah. So Philly Brown, which is your opening night film, and where is that that film? Oh, it's film is screening at the Victoria Theater, which is a really nice intimate facility that's really beautiful. It's got that Art Deco in there. It's really nice.
It is. We're really happy. I just came from there. So basically, we wanted to have a one screen theater where we can kind of do our own thing as far as like audience and the number of films and of course our little promotional circus that usually accompanies anything that's a festival, and so that facility really lends itself to this. And the film is, as you said, it's a film from the United States, Mm-hmm. It's directed by Michael Olmos and Yusuf Dilara. And these two filmmakers, I think some people may be familiar with Michael Olmos, but he's Zion, the son of Edward James Olmos, who also has a role in the film. And the film itself has, well, there has other family members involved. But this film came out earlier this year. It's not in general release. It just premiered at Sundance.
Oh, nice.
Where it was in competition. And from what we understand, the film is supposed to be released next year.
Oh, super, super. That's excellent. Yeah, because the storyline is just really wonderful. You know, you got a woman who is really great freestyle artist, and she, her father is, you know, he has a construction company with his friends, and she's got a cute sister that just wants to get into trouble, you know.
Right.
And she's trying to, like, keep a handle on that, and she's got an uncle that has a tattoo parlor, and then she's got a mom that's incarcerated. And the family, when we first come into the story, doesn't seem to, the girls don't seem to be connected to their mother, and we don't know how come. And the protagonist, Mayo, she, you know, she wants to be back connected to her mom, and so it really takes us on a lot of different excursions, not all of them great, trying to, because her father raised her, he's trying to, you know, sort of mend that family rift, and I just love it, because, you know, you don't have the really films showing the toll that incarceration takes on the family. You know, you can't just have a member, like, locked away and not be affected by that. Everybody's affected by that. Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But the music is just really phenomenal, too. So it's like we got that going on. You know, mom's in prison, and then we got this great music happening, and then we got this, you know, this, you know, sort of the back. How do you, like, you're talented. How do you promote yourself? And then we got this sleazy guy over here, and then we got these other folks over there, and then we got this really wonderful character that's Mayo's sort of like conscience, and he's like, you know, we don't want to sell out to, you know, to the exploitive kind of hip-hop that we could get into, because that's not where we are. And it's just really, I really liked it.
I'm glad you did. Good. I mean, that's one of the things about opening night films. It's like, you know, it does make a statement about your festival. And, you know, though, you know, we'd like to say it's one of those films that really anybody, whether you like hip-hop or not, or you like urban dramas or not, there's something there that you can appreciate. And it's always nice to see some of these actors that we're familiar with, whether it's Edward James Olmos or Lou Diamond Phillips, and just sort of seeing them once again on the screen, there's a certain satisfaction. And, of course, the newcomers, some of, you know, like Mayo's character played by Gina Rodriguez, and how, you know, in some ways the film in itself has opened the door not just to be a film star but also to be a performer. Because apparently she's now also pursuing a career in music.
Oh,
so it's, you know, so it's art, or life imitating art again.
Yeah. And then also, it just the currency of the film, and you didn't know that probably, but maybe you did, or maybe even the filmmaker might have been thinking about that too, with regards to incarcerated women. California incarcerates more women than any other place in the country, and maybe even the world. And Valley State Prison in Chowchilla is closing. They're going to be converting that to a men's prison, and all those women are going to relocate, be shifted. And just the way Mayo and her sister weren't able to touch their mother, that's the kind of situation that's going to be happening for these women. They're going to be in county facilities, which means they're going to have that glass in front of them because they're not equipped for contact visits.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and yeah, so the impact that might have on the families and the women, you know, being moved out to these different facilities that might not be equipped for, I mean, as opposed to releasing the women into treatment or something.
Right.
And then also looking at the ballot for November, there's a whole lot on it around prison
the death penalty and other, you know, early release and other kind of things. There's, I think there's like three or four things on the ballot that have to do with the prison industrial complex.
Right.
Yeah. Ah, so tell us about some of your other films. I don't know the companion film, Sin Padre. What's that about?
Right. Sin Padre is a local production by a first-time filmmaker by the name of J. Francisco Lopez, and it's locally shot with a lot of local talent in front and behind the camera.
Mm-hmm.
He's been promoting it a whole lot, and so it was one of those things that we wanted to couple a couple of urban tales and thought this was a good matchup. The story in itself is pretty heavy, to be quite honest. It has to do with something innocuous like a school assignment suddenly taking a much deeper sort of path into learning about your past and sometimes the past not being so good.
Mm.
And so in that essay, eventually it becomes a story about the darker side of his family life or his existence because of choices and situations that his mother went through. And so there's a reason why his father is not in her life, and he finds out the reason.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, very hard for him and traumatizing for the family. But it's a very, very powerful story made as a locally produced independent film.
Mm-hmm.
Quality is fantastic. The acting is great. The music is solid. Again, we have the music from a local band, if you're
mm-hmm.
familiar with the Malo.
Mm-hmm.
Today, a couple of the band members contributed some music to the film.
Oh, nice.
So there's a lot of heart and a lot of work that went into that production. But
mm-hmm.
the storyline itself, like I said, it's not necessarily upbeat, and
mm-hmm.
But if anything, it's one of those stories that it's wonderful that a young man is taking on a story like this,
mm-hmm.
and doing such a great job in bringing that to the film. And this is the first time it's filmed, screened actually,
mm-hmm.
Anywhere, because they're literally still finalizing the edit to the film
mm-hmm.
as of like 2 weeks ago. But based on what they had submitted, we felt that it was a super strong film that we could certainly include, and
mm-hmm.
and they were pretty certain they were going to be able to finish it by the time the festival rolled around.
Oh, great.
Yeah, so that's one of the films. And, yeah, so we have a lot of other films, but, you know,
mm-hmm.
like you already mentioned, it runs a full range of topics and genres,
mm-hmm.
From fantasy and comedy to thrillers and historical dramas. So
mm-hmm.
The sad part about it is that we could only screen films a couple of times.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of different sorts of films for everyone quite a few films that are documentaries
mm-hmm.
made by women. Films like Maestra, which is a documentary about women in it. A literacy program is initiated in Cuba back in the 60s during the Cuban Revolution. I believe you're going to have Catherine on the phone on later today.
Right, yeah, and I've interviewed Catherine before when the film was just finished. I don't know if it was last year or not, and she... she screened it at La Pena Cultural Center in Berkeley. But back to Sin Padre, I wanted to mention to you that I think it's really cool that you partnered, in the same program, Philly Brown with Sin Padre, because in the one film it's the absent mother, and in this film is the absent father. And is this film, Sin Padre, is that a documentary film?
No.
Oh,
it's a narrative feature.
It's a narrative.
It's a narrative feature. So it's a pretty heavy film,
mm-hmm.
but it's not a documentary, and it does touch on violence
mm-hmm.
and gangs and
okay.
and single families and
mm-hmm.
rape and
just, oh wow,
the whole that's what I'm saying, that I'm being a little bit vague, but at the same
mm-hmm.
time it's just heavy, and
mm-hmm.
and I think sometimes when you come out of the gate by saying
mm-hmm.
A film is it touches on all those different topics, you're almost thinking, oh, why would I want to go see a film to escape and say, okay, I'm going to go watch gangs and poor people and tough people and rape and, you know, all of these different parts of our society that are victimized. But it's a wonderful film, and it's just a very great story on the part of the filmmaker. But I wanted to sort of, I wanted to mention another film that is also a degree of musicality, which is a film called Bert Solari. Bert Solari is a film that is from Spain. It's primarily in Euskadi or Basque. But the great thing about that film has to do with how it feels. Bert Solari basically is like a spoken word artist.
Okay.
So it's the traditional spoken word of the Basque country. And much like when we say spoken word, we kind of think about urban and more like slam poetry, that sort of thing. And it's the same sort of practice there in the Basque country, except they take a slightly different approach. But like here in the U.S., it's much celebrated, and it's one of those things where they even have a huge competition where people take a topic and then they have to run with it and rhyme and have rhythm and a musical flow to what they have to say. So it's interesting to me, or it would be interesting to anybody who comes from, I think, maybe more of an urban background, who always thinks of language and poetry in light of, like, America, through the American lens of slam poetry. And to see something that really comes from, you know, from European tradition, a Spanish tradition, and seeing how they present it in the film and that, you know, spoken word has been around for so much longer than the written form, that the way that we communicate is something that all cultures, because of language and spoken word, that's the way we've always passed things down from one generation to the next. So they really put it into the historical context about language and this particular art form.
Right, yeah. I want to go through a list of the films that I circled that I thought were great. But before that, can you tell our audience how to get tickets? And I think you have some sold-out events already.
Yes, we have. You can visit our website, sflatinofilmfestival.org or .com, SF, like San Francisco, sflatinofilmfestival.com or .org. Or you could also do a search in brownpapertickets.com. That's our ticketing platform, Brown Paper Tickets. And whether you put in the word Billy Brown or Maestra or Latino Film Festival, you should be able to find us relatively easily.
Tickets are
$10 or $12. For students and youth and seniors, they're $10 and $12 for adult general public, but we have a couple of free screenings as well. We're folding into the East Side Arts Alliance screenings of films over on the 28th at the end of the month. And we're going to be showing a documentary called Children of Memory or Niños de la Memoria, which is a wonderful film. It's a U.S. production, but it's about children that were taken from their families when they were during the Salvadorian Civil War, and now it's a matter of reconciling what happened then. A lot of times when those disappeared, they ended up adopted in foreign countries, so they really were taken away from their families of anybody who survived. So it's a wonderful project, and that's when we screened it a few times, but there is a free screening in East Bay for that one, and we have another event where it's at the Mexican Heritage Plaza on September 27th, so that's one day before, down in San Jose, and we'll be screening, it's a co-presentation with another radio network, or TV network, I should say, and it's a free open to the public event with two films called, one's called Mariachi High, which deals with a music program in South Texas,
Mm-hmm.
And the other film is Tales of Masked Men. On our calendar, we don't have too much information about those films, but basically it's they're films that eventually will be on PBS.
Oh, okay.
And they're 1 hour length films that are very family friendly. So those are the two different events that we have that are free and open to the public.
Yeah, well, Catherine is in the studio now, but I was really interested. I thought you have some Bombing Arizona looked interesting, the graffiti artist highlighted there, and then La Vida Loca, and Every Time I Remember, I Forget. What other ones that I like? Justice for My Sister, we're going to have Kimberly on the air to talk about that. Let's see. You got like a lot of great films. A Doctor's Job.
That's an action. Yep. There's a lot of films. I mean,
yeah. Every Time
so
I Remember, I Forget. It's
that's a wonderful.
Really good film.
Yeah, that's a really great film. That's part of our shorts program, Latin American Shorts. But basically, it's one of those things where when I'm asked, you know, which particular film to zero in on, it honestly it's become such a challenge because we like every single one of them and we want everyone to see them all. But if you can catch just even one screening, I think you get a sense of the kind of films and quality of film and storytelling that is being produced and made by these wonderful filmmakers both from the U.S. and from Latin America and Spain.
Right, yeah. And so how did you find out about Catherine Murphy's film Maestra, which looks at this wonderful literacy program in Cuba in 1961?
That film was one of the films that was submitted.
Oh.
So we have a submission process where films are submitted into our festival for consideration, and it was one of the ones that arrived.
Yeah, did you know about this literacy program prior to the film that you saw, that you made?
I knew about the literacy program, but I hadn't actually seen something about it before.
Yeah. Well, Catherine, welcome to the show. You want to say hi to the festival director, Lucho, before he takes off?
Thank you, Lucho. Hey, Wanda. Good to talk to you guys.
Good to talk to you as well. Thank you. We'll have a wonderful interview here.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us, Lucho.
Thank you. Did get a chance to ask you,
do you have any films in the festival? Are you a filmmaker? Is that how you got into directing this festival?
No, I came through it purely out of film appreciation and not as a filmmaker.
Nice, okay. Wow, well, this is a really wonderful, it's a really fine program you've pulled together with your team.
Thank you. Well, it's really the stories sourced from all of these different wonderful filmmakers and end up learning about it. So we're very happy that all of these works come through. And if anything, we feel bad that we're not able to include more or to exhibit even more than we already do. But I think with a bit of time with support with media outlets like yours, you know, surely we'll be able to grow and be able to see things more frequently.
Oh, certainly, certainly. Well, you take good care and congratulations.
Thank you.
And thanks so much for being on the
Thank
show
you.
This afternoon.
Thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
So, Catherine, you've been on the show before. Let me refresh our audience's memory. You're a San Francisco-based filmmaker who spent much of the last 20 years working in Latin America. You've lived and worked in Cuba in the 1990s, earning a master's degree in sociology from the University of Havana. Currently, you are an adjunct professor at New York University's Center for Global Affairs and founder and director of the Literacy Project. So tell us about the Literacy Project and about the story that Maestra tells.
Well, the Cuban Literacy Campaign of 1961 was a peak moment in the social history of the Americas, in which the entire nation of Cuba set out to become fully literate, or to teach all adults that wanted to learn how to read and write. You know, thousands and thousands of adults. There were 1 million adults were deemed to be functionally or completely illiterate at that time. And through an open call for volunteer teachers, they hoped to offer education to all of those people who have been previously, you know, marginalized or excluded from an education process.
Mm-hmm.
So I started collecting stories about the literacy campaign about more than 5 years ago now, with sort of the desire to share this incredibly huge and inspiring phenomenon with folks in the United States. And we know so little about Cuba here in the U.S., and there are so many beautiful things for us to learn from Cuba, and one of them is through this example of the literacy campaign, and that, you know, it really is possible to bring quality education to all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the Literacy Project, it was something that was sort of undertaken by then-President Fidel Castro. And in your film, you know, it was more than a notion. These young people committed themselves to going into the country and bringing, you know, books and literacy, you know, reading and writing to those people that weren't necessarily in the cities where there were schools and things like that. And you highlight a lot of, you know, young women. And then they talk about then and they talk about now and how that really changed their lives. And while they were, you know, going out into the country doing this great, great service, you know, for their country and for their people, something happened. You know, U.S., I don't know, did we bomb something? Did we attack? I mean, it was some danger.
We invaded.
Okay.
So the Bay of Pigs invasion, right, many people here learn about the Bay of Pigs invasion, but they had no idea that right at that moment there were over 250,000 volunteer teachers that were all over the countryside in the mountains and valleys around the country living with rural families and teaching folks how to read and write. And that was one of the reasons why Cuban people basically spontaneously rose up and stopped the invasion.
Mhm. Right. Yeah. And then the poor parents, you know, back home, you know, they're like, "Oh, my child is, you know, on some mountain somewhere." And
right.
Yeah.
In
so talk about
danger.
Yeah. Talk about these great stories and you know and there's a connection with regards to your there's a personal connection to this whole idea of teaching and of reading and of writing. Yeah, so if you could talk a little bit about some of these women and men, some of these characters that, you know, that you show, because you have some great archival footage, you know, then and now, and that you highlight that are talking about, you know, this great moment that, you know, really was pivotal in the shaping of their lives. Because afterwards, people were changed, and they went on to do great things in their country. In service.
Yeah. So the film was really inspired by a group of women, Cuban women that I knew. One of them was Dr. Norma Guillard, who is a leading social psychologist in Cuba today. And the other is a really amazing woman named Daisy Leitia, who was a leading hospital architect. And both of them, there's another woman named Hina Ray, who started one of the first, interdisciplinary kind of urban studies, urban development centers in Cuba. They were these incredible women that I had the opportunity to know and to meet and to know when I was studying Cuba in the 90s. And they all said that the most important moment in their lives was the most important thing they ever did was when they were teenagers and they taught some rural elders how to read and write. And it really struck me as found it really, really moving and this incredibly inspiring story that has a lot to teach the rest of us around the world. And part of why, you know, when they made an open call, because yes, you know, Cuba made an open call for volunteer teachers that followed the UN General Assembly in 1960 in September, Cuba actually announced that they would become fully literate